Welcome to the Nottingham Business School Business Leaders Podcast, where business leaders tell their stories and share their insights. All our guests have a personal connection with Nottingham Business School. So listen, learn, enjoy and share.
Welcome to another episode of the Nottingham Business School's Business Leaders Podcast with me, Mike Sassy. So Matt Wallace is an entrepreneur. 12 years ago, he was at the forefront of digital content development when he founded the Jano Media Agency. Now, as an alumnus of Nottingham Trent Uni and one-time president of the student union, he had previously spent 10 years working in corporate communications. Now he has his own production company with 8 staff, more than 50 clients, and a healthy annual turnover. Always eager to remember his roots, 2 years ago, Matt set up the Jano Media Award bursary for aspiring podcasters at Nottingham Trent. And that's just one of the reasons we're very happy to welcome Matt Wallace to this episode of the Nottingham Business School's Business Leaders Podcast.
Nice to see you. I'd appreciate the invitation. Thank you. Just listening to the kind of things that you're saying about me, you make me sound old, Mike. Blimey. Sounds like a lot's happened in there, but I don't know as I remember all of it.
It's just we've got pictures so people can see that. You're actually just a spring chicken. Yeah. So, Matt, owner and driving force behind Jano Media. So what does that involve?
I mean, these days, I guess these days I'm more of a sort of, I call myself a bit of a principal steer on production. So where we go out to film, to record, to live stream, whatever it might be, I tend to be sort of the lead on the production side of things. I'm very blessed and lucky now to have a team of people around me that deal with elements of pre-production and marketing for the business and operational direction and all that kind of stuff. So day to day, you'd find me maybe on a shoot somewhere. But I guess beyond that, I'm kind of take the lead on the strategic direction of the business as well. Some strategic oversight.
I was just going to say, yeah. So you own the business. It begins and starts with you. The book stops on your desk. But you're still very hands-on.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's important. You have to be, because there's no greater way to understand how your business is evolving and developing and working than being on the ground, meeting with the clients, seeing your staff in action, understanding what works and what doesn't. And it's an evolving thing. It's always changing. So you have to be, it's an old term, isn't it? At the coalface, so to speak. But putting your hands on the tools and being involved, it's invaluable.
Yeah, on the tools, I recognise that one. So you set up Jano back in 2012, and you very kindly have online, you've written a very potted history of your years in business. Yeah. So I picked up a few lines from there. So it was as a result of a PPI windfall for younger listeners. That's a mis-selling scandal of the 2000s, payment protection insurance. But we'll skate over that one. So PPI windfall, yeah. A long sponsored walk, a chat with your 4-year-old cousin. So tell us all how that all happened.
I'll put that in order for you. So I used to work at Nottingham Trent University. I worked in corporate comms and spent the latter part of my jobs and career there at NTU working in the press office. But I stopped doing that, gave that up in 2011 to go and do a sponsored walk for Cancer Research UK. I chose to walk from John O'Groats to Land's End via every Cancer Research UK research centre in the
country. How many was
that? It's about 14 of them.
God. Sorry. 14?
Yeah, about 14 of them. Yeah, and I think the total distance I covered was probably between 1,500 to 2,000 miles. I've never added it up on the exact mileage. But it took me about 5.5 months to do. And the idea of the walk was principally to raise money for Cancer Research UK, but also to do something based on my skill set about telling the stories of these research centres, filming little videos, meeting the people that work there and sharing what they do to encourage greater participation and involvement in supporting that cause. So I finished that in about the 10th of March 2012, I finished that. And then found myself sat on my parents' sofa without a job, without a home, because I'd literally given it all up to do that fundraising walk. I was just eating my mum and dad's food and watching their telly, signing on. I was going down the job centre because I didn't have an idea really of what I wanted to do.
Signing on, now wait a minute, you showed your age there as well, go on.
I know, yeah, queuing up, I was. But I was pleased to do that. I needed to find work, But then a day came when I was sat on that very sofa watching that very TV, and those adverts, I mean, you mentioned PPI, I don't know if you remember the adverts that used to come up on the telly, did you pay PPI, payment protection insurance, on a loan? And I thought, you know what, I bet I was stupid enough when I was younger to have done that when I was 21, because back then, when I was 21, they'd throw money at you, the banks. You get a graduate loan for nothing. And I took a grad loan for about £10,000 because I was that silly, and paid payment protection insurance on it, rang the bank and said, did I pay PPI? And they went, oh yeah, Mr. Wallace, you did. Shall we send you the paperwork? And I said, yes, please. And I answered it all very honestly. You know, I filled it in. I didn't have one over on them at all. But within, I think, 3 weeks, I had a check through the door for £3,500.
And you used that to set up your business.
That was my seed funding. Yeah, that was the money that I got from that payment. I remember sitting down with mum and dad and saying, look, fair's fair. You're putting me up here. But I've had this money. I've got this daft idea. Well, not daft idea. Well, maybe it was daft. We'll decide later. But this idea that I'd like to really lean into what I enjoyed most about the job when I was working as a press officer, which was working in video, doing press work, but championing the use of video in media relations and press activity. And I wanted to set up a video production
company.
That's
interesting.
And I used that money.
You described yourself at one point, I think, as a hobbyist.
Mm.
And as a result, you considered this to be a low-risk punt.
Is that my words? Yeah, a low-risk punt.
But I'm saying, if £3,500 is all you've got in the world, that's still a risk.
It is. I guess the low risk for me was having that safety net of being able to still be at mum and dad's house. You know, I wasn't going to be out on the air. If it had all gone wrong, I had a net there to catch me if things had gone awry. But yes, took the money and went and bought, if I remember rightly, an iMac, a very small DSLR camera, one lens and an audio recorder and a tripod. And that was the beginnings of Jana
Media.
Okay,
so I'm just going to chug in there. Where was the conversation with your four-year-old cousin?
The four-year-old cousin. Oh, that was in the name selection.
Oh, name selection, right.
Okay, so, and you know what it's like. When people set businesses up, you can spend no end of your life trying to come up with a funky name that describes who you are and what you do and make it sound appealing and very marketable. And I couldn't get my head around what name or brand I wanted to create around this. My little cousin at the time, he was only four. He's now, well, he'll be 17 this October. But yeah, talking to him, he used to start every sentence, as a lot of kids sometimes do, by saying, do you know, Matt? He used to sit down and have a chat with me. He'd say, Matt, do you know this? Do you know that? Do you know? And I thought it was this really lovely little affectation that he had as a youngster. And I thought he's trying to say, do you know? And I'd quite like the sound. And I'd listened to a couple of podcasts at the time. I think I remember about this agonizing journey of picking a name. And some of the most obscure names, you know, two syllables, very memorable, a nice sound to it. And that Jano just stood out to me. Not only that, I discovered it was available as a website, so I took it.
So no, you've just hinted at something else there that you said, I'd listened to a couple of podcasts about this process. So wait a minute. So that's 12, 13 years ago. So you're a little bit ahead of the game there. You know, you're already making your decisions, doing your research based on podcasts. So to what extent as a relatively early adopter in digital content, did that sort of give you a competitive advantage?
It's interesting. I mean, when I was in the press office, so working as a press officer, I was there when Twitter became a thing, when YouTube became a thing, Facebook was becoming a thing. And I don't think it took us by surprise, but it had us taking stock of, well, what are these mediums by which people are now consuming news in particular at that point? And it was that idea and understanding of, well, journalists are using Twitter. I mean, you, as a journalist yourself, you know, you remember Twitter emerging.
Oh, God, yes. 10 years ago, every 10, 12, 15 years ago, everybody wanted to be on it. It's just full of journalists, isn't it?
Yeah. And it was, I guess, maybe what I took stock of and interest in was that digital landscape and saying there's not just these platforms, but these content methods as well. It can be just written text. 140 characters was what Twitter used to be, being able to point a message on Twitter towards certain people. But then being able to supplement it with video or being able to supplement it with audio content as well. And, you know, it ran away very, very quickly. Everything on that content creation side of things became massive. But I think maybe the competitive advantage for me maybe was that I had an appreciation and an understanding of it from a professional point of view, appreciating the value of that content in affecting good communication. The big thing for me was that the iPhone. That was the platforms were there, but the thing that changed everything, I remember, being the device.
And having that in your pocket as opposed to on the screen in front of you.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I've said this a lot of times to clients of mine, some that are still shy about the idea of video. And I think that comes from video used to be something that you wheeled into a room.
You remember being a kid at school? Screens that never worked.
Yeah, video got wheeled in on a great big, you know, big steel cabineted TV with a VHS machine underneath it, and you had to be in that room in front of that telly to watch that video. It translated over to desktop; we could watch on our computers. But once the iPhone became the device for video and audio and Twitter and Facebook and YouTube, and that was it. It was clear to me at that point how big it was going
to
be.
So it occurs to me that was the first time you had a competitive advantage, but then there was a reading through everything that you have written, that there's a second skill, because it looks to me, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, as though you had planned to really go into podcasting around 2020. You were moving in that direction. You were doing video. You were doing lots of different aspects of digital content. And you thought, look, podcasting is where it's at. We're going to offer this as part of our service to our clients. And then lockdown came about. So once again, you were ahead of the game.
A little bit, I think. Yeah, I mean, everybody got their hand forced in some way by lockdown, by that pandemic. You had a choice as a business owner at that point to either sit still and go, oh, it'll all come good, I'm sure. We'll take the furlough payments. We'll just let this blow over, whatever that might have looked like. Or you could sit there as a business owner and say, well, what are we going to do here to lean into the situation and capitalise on maybe an advantage or an opportunity that we might have? And what we saw was the video side of our business very quickly dropped off because we couldn't go out and film anything. So then it was a case, well, if we can't shoot video, we had to solve that problem, and we did. We came up with some remote production solutions, but audio then became a big thing. We could much more easily and readily record audio content for clients remotely and produce podcasts for them that allowed them, in their own dire needs of needing to communicate with their customers and their clients, to still get their message out there. And I think you'll see that I haven't got numbers to hand on this, but I would hazard a guess that the amount of corporate podcast content really spiked and took off from 2020.
And there's a bit of self-interest here in me asking you this question, but does anybody listen to them?
It all depends on how you use them. If you're going to put them out there, if you create a corporate, I'm going to call it a corporate podcast, but a podcast for a corporate entity, do not assume that it's going to become in any way viral, instantly likable, highly shareable, or anything like that. You have to create that content with a view to understanding what the intention of it is for your customers. And it's a slow grind. Being a podcaster is definitely a slow grind on that. But if you're able to make the content, maybe you've got a mailing list as a business owner, you know who your clients are, you've got means by which to send this content to them. And you can say, well, if you're interested, I had a chat the other day with so-and-so about this new development in our industry, about this piece of thought leadership, this new white paper that's being discussed in the House of Commons, all that kind of stuff. And people, I think, really appreciate the opportunity to listen to other people's thoughts and ideas around the topic.
Yeah, but I couldn't agree more. I'm going to focus on something you said there originally, because it's to do with audience, isn't it? It's to do with targeting. We're in newspapers and we're on websites. It's to do with who you're writing for, who you're producing your material for. How do you convince it? Because I always thought that people didn't quite recognise that. How do you get that across to your clients?
I mean, we always lean on the idea of an audience appreciating authenticity. It's something that we talk about a lot. And the value of the conversation, we always say, is not in the number of people that listen to it, but what you're able to convey in that conversation to just maybe one or two people. You know, it's being able to convince the client that you might not get 100,000 listens on it, but if you've only got 10 key people, stakeholders, clients, that are able to consume and understand what it is that you're saying, and then reinforce that idea in their own mind about who you are, what you do, why you have value to them as a vendor, a supplier, or whatever it might be, then that's how we convince them. It's that people appreciate the authenticity of
it. So let me go to another aspect of your business. Obviously, you all work remotely, and you were an early adoption again there, 2016. There are a couple of, if you don't mind me saying, a couple of very, very funny paragraphs that you've written about how you tried with an office and you guess what? You never used it, and for all different reasons. Yeah. I know people are going to have a look, read it, that it is very funny. But so you thought, I tell you what, 2016, I'm going remote. Now, subsequently, obviously, everybody else has gone remote as well. So you really were an early adopter there. But I always find, or always found, still find, that produces a whole new set of challenges with regard to leadership. How have you managed to get around those challenges?
The biggest challenge for me in that remote working idea is, particularly for someone like myself, I can be self-deprecating here to a certain extent about the kind of personality that I have, but the challenge is trust. That's what you really have to... You have to understand that you are trusting these people that you can't physically see that they are working. And it's difficult, I'm going to be honest with you, because everybody's different. Everybody has their own habits about how they spend their time when they're at home. You know, we hope that they're going to sit down and sit at their computer and diligently get on with the work that's in front of them. But I can't physically peer over their shoulder, as my old boss used to, and say, what is it that... You know, what's that you're writing there? What's that website you're looking at? You know,
Premier League,
like that.
Are we doing Premier League this morning?
it's difficult, and it's that is the key challenge, trusting people. But you have to foster and create an environment, a feeling for that person that works for you that they are trusted. And then I think the good work comes from
that. So how do you get them? I understand what you're saying. And I couldn't agree more. But how do you get them to buy into what you're doing, buy into you, buy into your company's ethos? Because I can see how you do it face-to-face, you know, nose-to-nose. You're talking to them constantly. You're shooting the breeze the whole time. You're having shared face-to-face experiences. But how do you do that with an online workforce?
I mean, staying in contact regularly, even if it is just by Teams calls, or we used to use Slack, but Teams these days, and keeping them up to date with the intention and the vision and the development of the business, not just making them feel like they're working in isolated silos, that the work that they're doing is contributing in some way to the growth and development of something that we're all collectively proud of building. But I think this is important, Mike, is that it's growing and developing in a way that we haven't necessarily defined yet what the final outcome is going to be. Our industry changes, you know, daily. There's new technology, new means and methods of working. And we keep, I think, a lot of our team members involved and excited about the industry that they work in by remaining responsive to those changes. We don't just say, this is how we make a video and we use the same bit of software forever. So we have conversations about that.
Let me take you to something completely different. One thing, again, I've seen that you've written about, but I find this with a lot of the entrepreneurs that I speak to, that they're always looking for a higher purpose, something beyond the pounds and pence. From the outside looking in at an entrepreneur, you know, you've got to make sure that your profitability is there and that the business is a success, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But often people in your position, and I believe you're the same, are looking for something beyond that. Tell me about that.
I mean, if your only motivation for owning a business and running a business is those pounds and pence, okay, you're very quickly, particularly in the early days, going to become unmotivated, okay, because cash is, it ebbs and flows. One minute you think you've cracked it, the next minute you think, I haven't got a clue. So if you're only motivated by that cash idea, turnover, profit, margins, headcounts, whatever it might be, you're going to come a cropper. Okay, so that idea of a higher purpose, as you phrase it, I think has to be maybe framed within the idea of a vision for the business. What are we actually doing? What is the contribution of what we do to a wider idea than just the bank balance? And we went through this process. This is, I mean, you've alluded to it already about these blog posts that I wrote on our 10th anniversary, our 10th birthday, of us trying to examine what we call, well, not what we call, but what is widely known as the why of a business. And what we ended up, I struggled with it, I'll be honest, probably about 2 years, I struggled with this idea of why. The book, Start With Why by Simon Sinek, somebody given that to me. And I read it and became so much more frustrated at the end of it. I thought it had answers in it, but instead it just gave me more questions on top of
the
why.
That's the problem with your self-help book, isn't it?
I know, it was agonizing. But we sat down and thought more and more about it. And what we came up with was this idea that our purpose, really, that why we do what we do, is kind of enshrined in the idea that the content that we create in whatever form it might be goes on to have a positive effect in some way to lives and society. Okay. Sometimes it's hard to square that away. But
there was a specific time, wasn't there? There was a specific thing that happened, a specific client, a specific job that you had that turned a corner for you, wasn't there?
There was, yeah, thank you for reminding me. We produced a piece of content for a big client of ours. It's a very large law firm, a big multinational law firm, and they had taken part in something called the This Is Me campaign, which was about encouraging people within the workplace to talk more about, you know, who they are, what their struggles are. Maybe it's mental health difficulties or alcoholism, or it can be anything. This idea of standing up and saying, this is me. And that year, I forget, it was probably about 2017, something like that, maybe, I think. I went and filmed a series of videos with this client, and these very brave people sat down with me in front of the camera and spoke about some of their challenges and things like that. And we produced a lovely video off the back of it, and it was well received. But then I discovered later that that piece of content had earned the opportunity for the person that had commissioned us to make it, a partner at this law firm. She'd been invited to go and give this presentation at this big fancy do about the success of their This Is Me campaign and the content that we'd produced. And I spotted that on LinkedIn, and I thought, you know what, that's the why for us. If we're making content that has positive impact and affects change and contributes in some way to a better feeling for a person or a group, That's
it was very moving. I sat and watched it, and I could see exactly what you were on about. The idea of somebody going through their own, a very successful person going through their own mental health history that you would never have guessed, and she did it ever so well, because it was a journalist by trade, so it was the drop intro thing where she just talked and talked and talked, and then suddenly bang, it was, and you were thinking, yes, now I understand. It was a very moving piece. So you know, we're talking now about the nitty gritty of your business. But what else do you know now that you wish you'd known 12, 13 years ago when you started?
I think time, I think, is a big thing for me. I wish I'd known that things take longer than you'll ever think they will take, okay? And that you've got to be patient, okay, in growing a business. Nothing happens quickly. Or nothing that you do well happens quickly. Let's maybe phrase it that way. You've got to be patient with yourself. You've got to be patient with other people. You've got to be resilient and stick at it. And all of that takes time. And I think in the early days of running a business, you want to hit the ground running, get as much stuff done as you can, bang, 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 and I'm going to be a success and whatever else. But yeah, that idea of appreciating and understanding that to do something well takes time. I wish I'd had that conversation with myself sooner.
What's been the most enjoyable thing you've done?
For me, the biggest enjoyment for me is, I don't know if I sound disingenuous in saying this, but creating jobs for me, I think I've always held as being the biggest marker of success for the business. Okay, there's now 8 of us in the company. That's 8 jobs that didn't exist before I built what we've built, or I, with the help of others, have built what we have. And that's what I enjoy most, being able to see that people can take up gainful employment
that
with
gainful
us.
Employment, that's a responsibility though as well, isn't it?
It is, and there's a lot that goes with that. You have to worry about how, you know, do we have all the tools available for this person to be able to do their job well, for them to enjoy the job, for them to succeed at what they're doing, to develop and grow their own career aspirations. I mean, for me to be a good boss, I don't look at anybody and think, I need you to be successful and stay here with me. I think the only fair thing is that I would look at my own employees and say, for you to be successful, I want you to grow and develop while you're here, and then go on to even better things than I can offer you. But yeah, I mean, there's all sorts that goes with it. Like paying pensions, for example, you've got to do all of that as well, and national insurance and all of those. But it's I do honestly mean this. I count that as a privilege, in all honesty, to be able to make a contribution in some way to other people through that employment.
Not a business school, a place where there are a lot of leaders and would-be leaders. So if after your 12, 13 years of experience as an entrepreneur, you had one piece of leadership advice that you could offer everyone here, what might that be?
I think it would be generous. Okay, that's my advice. Okay, be generous with your time, and use that generosity of time not just for yourself. Okay, give time back to yourself, but just as importantly, give that time to other people as well, and use that time to learn and to listen and to develop and to grow yourself and others, because you have to. And I don't really have a very succinct and concise answer to that, but this idea of being generous in some way, be it with your time, maybe with your money if you want to be generous in that way, but investment, I guess, is my feeling.
And it'll reap its own rewards.
It has to. I think it does, but that comes right back to being patient. It does reap its own rewards, some of it not very quickly, and some successes manifest themselves in ways that you won't even notice or recognize until maybe 3-4 years down the line. You think, crikey, that one thing that I did there went on to have a knock-on effect that's created this whole different outcome that would never have been thought of.
Great stuff. So Matt Wallace, owner, chief executive, Jano Media. Thanks very, very much for being our guest on the Nottingham Business School's Business Leaders Podcast.
It's been a pleasure, Mike. Thanks ever so much.
If you've enjoyed this episode of the NBS Business Leaders Podcast, why not listen to previous episodes with the MD of global financial services company Experian, José Luis Rossi, entrepreneur and broadcaster Michael Heyman, MBE, and the Vice Chancellor of Nottingham Trent University, Professor Edward Peck, CBE. This episode of the Nottingham Business School Business Leaders Podcast is produced for Nottingham Trent University by Russell Bingley and presented by Mike Sassy.